indiscriminately. One of them says, "Look at them, nice." Another says, after they fire at the civilians. Saleh Muntasser Tuman, a van driver, drives onto the scene, stops, and gets out to help the injured, including Saeed Chamak. The pilots request permission to fire at the van. They are rapidly granted authorization and begin to open fire. Minutes later, Army Specialist Ethan McCord, part of the 2-16 battalion in which Finkel was embedded, surveys the scene from the ground. In 2010, McCord told Wired Kim Vetter what he had witnessed. "I have never seen anybody being shot by a 30mm round before. It didn't seem real, in the sense that it didn't look like human beings. They were destroyed." In the van, McCord and other troops found Sajjad Muntasher, aged 10, and Doha Muntasher, aged 5, badly injured. Their father, Saleh, was dead on the ground. In the video, the pilot saw that there were children in the van. "Well," he said callously, "it's their fault for bringing kids into the battle." When WikiLeaks released the video, then 12-year-old Sajjad Muntasher said, "I want to get our rights from the Americans who harmed us." His mother, Ahlam Abdul Hussein Tuman, said, "I would like the American people and the whole world to understand what happened here in Iraq. We lost our country and our lives were destroyed." They were met with silence. Sajjad, who recovered partly from his injuries, was killed by a car bomb in Baghdad in March of 2021. Robert Gibbs, press secretary for former U.S. President Barack Obama, said in April 2010 that the events depicted in the video were extremely tragic, but the cat was out of the bag. "This video showed the world the actual character of the U.S. war on Iraq, which United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan called illegal. Neither U.S. President George W. Bush nor U.K. Prime Minister Tony Blair have had to answer the charge of the illegality of their war against Iraq, although Iraqi journalist Muntasher al-Zaidi did throw his shoes at Bush in Baghdad in 2008 while saying, 'This is a farewell kiss from the Iraqi people, you dog.'" And filmmaker David Lally Wacklin did interrupt Blair's testimony at the Leveson Inquirer in 2012 to call him a war criminal. When WikiLeaks and Assange released that video, they embarrassed the United States regime. All its claims of humanitarian warfare lost credibility. It is from this point onwards that the U.S. regime, whether under the charge of Obama, Trump, or Biden, sought to punish Assange. Assange had to be brought to the United States and thrown into prison. No one was going to be allowed to get away with revealing the truth of U.S. warmongering. In 2019, the government of Ecuador ejected Assange from his refuge in its London embassy and turned him over to British authorities. A few days later, the British government explained why the WikiLeaks founder was sitting in Belmarsh prison. We can confirm that Julian Assange was arrested in relation to a provisional extradition request from the United States of America. He is accused in the United States of America of computer-related offenses. The U.S. Justice Department said that Assange was wanted for a computer hacking conspiracy, but Assange did not hack into any computer. The material was collected by Chelsea Manning, who passed it on to WikiLeaks, which published it along with a range of media outlets. Assange is a journalist and a publisher, not a hacker. It is journalism that is being punished. That is why 8 media houses from around the world joined together to publish a statement on the recent British court decision that Assange can be extradited to the United States. This statement is here. On December 10th, Human Rights Day, a British court delivered a verdict that clears the way for the extradition of journalist and publisher Julian Assange to the United States. If the extradition goes through, Assange will face criminal prosecution in the U.S., including under the infamous U.S. Espionage Act. And if convicted, he could spend the rest of his life in jail. Julian Assange and his organization WikiLeaks published vital information received from whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning that chronicled U.S. war crimes and atrocities in Iraq and Afghanistan. This includes collateral murder, the horrifying video that showed U.S. military personnel killing Iraqi civilians, including two journalists. WikiLeaks revelations also exposed corruption and human rights violations by governments across the world, and these reports have been carried and cited by media organizations globally. It is for this crime of journalism that Julian Assange has been persecuted for over a decade. He is the first publisher to be charged under the Espionage Act. The U.S. regime and its allies across the world have refused to accept the fact that Assange is a journalist. The persecution of Julian Assange is thus a fundamental assault on journalism, press freedom, and freedom of expression. The under-designed media organizations reject and denounce this attack on Julian Assange and journalism. Freedom of the press will remain a hollow phrase as long as Julian Assange and WikiLeaks continue to be hounded. In 2004, the Iraqi artist Nuha al-Raidi died from leukemia caused by depleted uranium that the United States used in Iraq. Her captivating book, Baghdad Diaries, A Woman's Chronicle of War and Exile in 2003, tells us about the suffering endured by all living beings in her native Baghdad during the U.S. bombing of Iraq in 1991. The birds have taken the worst beating of all. They have sensitive souls which cannot take all this hideous noise and vibration. All the caged lovebirds have died from the shock of the blast, while birds in the wild fly upside down and do crazy somersaults. Hundreds, if not thousands, have died in the orchard. Lonely survivors fly about in a distracted fashion. On January 28, 2007, a few months before he was killed by the U.S. Army's Apache helicopter, Namir Nuruddin went to a secondary school in the Adil district of Baghdad, where a mortar attack had killed five female pupils. Nuruddin took a photograph of a young boy walking past a pool of blood with a football under his arm. Beside the bright red blood lies a few rumpled the school books. It was Nuruddin's humane eye that took this powerful picture of what had become normal in Iraq. This is what the U.S. illegal war has done to his country. Assange, who published a story about Nuruddin's death, sits in his cell, waiting to be extradited. After the verdict of the higher court, the journalist John Pilger observed, "Recently, I passed Tony Blair's £8 million mansion in London's Connaught Square. It's an hour's bleak journey to Belmarsh Prison, where Julian Assange lives in a small cell. This is British Christmas 2021. The war criminal rewarded, the truth teller punished, perhaps to death."
the Shaheed,
Part 3.
During the Syrian war, I was traveling with a Syrian nun from Damascus, Latakia. She had witnessed the bloodshed and the killings and how minorities, Christian, Alevis, Shias, were attacked by the extremists. She told me that she still could not figure out how it was possible for us to be Muslims and Islamists and yet be against the terrorists who also claim to be Muslims and in fact even defend minorities like Christians,
Alevis,
and their churches. The answer to this question lies in the thought, behavior, and actions of the likes of Shahid Qasem Soleimani. If it were not for him, many of churches, synagogues, temples, shrines, and mosques of the region would have been destroyed. I'm Sarbaz Zuhullah Rizvi, and in this episode, let's have a look into the measures that Haj Qasem took to protect religious minorities of the region. Stay with us. Father Antonios Hanania, originally from Acre, Palestine, currently in Syria. Father Hanania, thank you for accepting our invitation.
You're very welcome. It is our pleasure and we are honored to be able to share with you today about this holy and important event.
Yes. As you know, the program is about General Qasem Soleimani at the second martyrdom anniversary of him. You tell us about the role that Shahid Soleimani played defending followers of other faiths, defending Christians, defending the church. What's your stand on that as a father?
It is very important to take into consideration that when we talk about General Qasem Soleimani, we are talking about a true Islam that does not differentiate between Sunnah and Shia, because the enemy, the Zionist enemy, is trying to basically create a sort of war between denominations and between religions.
And
this is where we see, the intervention of General Qasem Soleimani to overturn the tables against the enemy and showing that the Iranian forces and the Syrian forces and the Palestinian, the true Palestinian forces, and all the forces that our allies, as well as in Yemen and many other places, we care about one thing, that God is the God of all. And all of us have one important mission, to liberate Palestine, so that each religion and each denomination lives beside the other one in peace. And the true Islam of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, the true Islam does not differentiate between a Christian and a Muslim, and even a Jew, if that particular Jew is a decent one. Therefore, the mission of General Qasem Soleimani is not a religious mission. It is a national mission, a humane mission. It is a humane mission, and this is why the Christian, the true Muslim, if he is Sunnah or if he is Shia, if he is Ismaili, if he is Alawi, if he is even a Druze, he can live and coexist side by side with whose eyes are on Palestine. Without our mission, without seeing Palestine in the horizon, every war we are basically waging against the enemy will not have a decent purpose. The decent purpose of the liberation of Palestine, with the help of the Iranian Islamic Republic, as well as the Revolutionary Guard, has this holy mission, and that particular holy mission is to liberate Al-Quds. And when we liberate Al-Quds, everyone is welcome to come to Al-Quds. This is the texture of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian revolution, is to preserve every person who loves Palestine. Palestine is a big heart for everyone. How is it then if we are taking into consideration General Qasem Soleimani, the martyr, who basically sacrificed a lot for Palestine, almost all his life, in order to fight for Palestine and to preserve all the religions side by side to live in peace? This is the true peace, not the peace imposed by the Zionists and the Americans and all their allies. It's a false peace based on lies and false promises.
You dragged me to somewhere else, and thank you for your comment. You talked about peace, and Christianity yes. is known to be the religion of peace. But you mentioned yes. that, and the terminology of peace is something commonly yes. being used by United States of America and the Zionist regime, that we are looking after peace processes, peace talks, yes. peace events, peace delegations, peace accords, and blah, blah, blah. Yes. And you are yes. telling me another peace. What is basically different? And you are telling me that General Qasem Soleimani was also looking after peace. Make it a little bit more clear for us. Elaborate it for us more. What was that peace that General Qasem Soleimani was looking for?
The peace of Qasem Soleimani, General Qasem Soleimani, is a peace based on justice. And that justice requires the liberation of Palestine from this cancerous Zionist evil plan that was planted in a holy land. And this is why, when we talk about peace, we know from the beginning of Christianity and Islam, that these Zionists, at that time, long time ago, were known as Pharisees. Pharisees hating the Christians and hating the Muslims, trying to create problems and conflicts within each of these religions. This is why, when we look at the beginning of Islam, we see Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam reaching out, living among all those hunafa, those hanif, who were tired of al-maghdub alayhim, and tired of those who are dalil. This is why today history repeats itself. We still have among us those who are maghdub alayhim and those who are dalil. In that particular situation, General Qasem Soleimani, representing a true Islamic approach to the resolution of such conflicts, I say, it is when we are fighting, khususan, especially from the Zurriya, Immat Baytullah Al-Athhar, when we are represented by true Islam, that is represented by the household of Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam, all the Christians who at the beginning of Islam were treated with respect and love and patience, this is the true peace. Islam, the true Islam is an Islam of peace. It is Islam of peace with surrounding this ummah, if we want to say.
Exactly.
The other peace by the Americans and yeah. Their allies. It's a pseudo peace. It is a peace escorted by deception, because the Zionists, as well as the Americans, they use the philosophy of Niccolo Machiavelli, who wrote the book of the Prince, and they say that the leader can use deception in order to win and deceive the enemy. They will not deceive us. As we say, they will be deceived by their own schemes, because we have the truth, and whoever fights the truth will basically conquer that particular person. Exactly. And we hold the truth.
Exactly. Exactly. I will continue my talk, and I will continue my discussion with Father Antonius Hanania from Syria just after a short part, which is about the, you know, reflection of the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani at social media and the censorship that actually took place in social media against General Qasem Soleimani. So stay with us.
General Soleimani's martyrdom by assassination was followed by different reactions by personalities and people of all walks and nationalities, often unexpected reaction. To go for facts before comments on the facts, what actually happened is not supported by proof or sound legal reasoning. America claimed imminent threats by Soleimani, but how and why, based on proof of what supposed plot against America and American lives, was Soleimani assassinated? According to Agnes Callamard, Secretary General of Amnesty International, the Pentagon's statement following the attack on General Soleimani was seriously vague and lacking sufficient evidence. On the phone with Guterres, the UN Secretary General, Iran's then Foreign Minister Javad Zarif recalled Soleimani's role in fighting terror groups, saying his popularity with the people of the region could mean repercussions out of everyone's control. Reaction to the American State Terrorism Act, that is. Guterres agreed America's act would heighten tensions in the region. Iranian authorities at large, including the leader of the Islamic Revolution, promised or warned America of serious revenge on those with hands stained by the blood of Soleimani and companions. Statements by Iranian dignitaries aroused a tsunami of tweets by Iranians. They tweeted in English via the hashtag severe revenge. Other regional states and the subcontinent also put out hashtags of their own in condemning the murder. Unexpected, however, was the reaction by the American people. They took hashtag severe revenge pretty seriously. Americans against Donald Trump's warmongering wrote to Dear Iran, appealing to Iranian authorities not to start a war with the U.S. Some Americans made jokes of the threats, but hashtag severe revenge did become a trend with them, which means the Americans mostly took it pretty seriously. CNN and Washington Post tweeted separately on Iran's promise of revenge and were retweeted by the people massively. Intellectuals supporting Trump's political opponents believe he assassinated the general based on a lie. They accused him of warmongering. Tulsi Gabbard, a U.S. presidential nominee in 2020, circulated a video that implied the assassination was an error of judgment by Trump and that it only brought America closer to war. A year after the assassination, Pakistanis and Indians started a campaign with hashtag hero, and that's a global trend now. In the region, Dr. Al-Lawati, a famous Omani, noted Ismail Haniyeh's visit to the general's family. Bahrainis also condemned the U.S. act. Al-Mayadeen TV on Twitter covered the news of the Soleimani assassination, condemning it while showing Iraq's hashtag Sha'bi commanders in battle gear. Lebanese journalists also condemned the U.S. crime, and Iraqi users started hashtag Al-Lawa Al-Adeem to express their feelings. Most all famous Persian speakers on social media commented. Political account holders used Twitter, while others posted on Instagram. What can't be overlooked is that Instagram simply deleted trending posts featuring the picture of Sardar Soleimani. This social media platform not only deleted posts depicting Soleimani, but even suspended the accounts of famous people posting pictures of the general.
I'm hosting Father Antonius Hanania, originally from Palestine and currently in Syria. Father Hanania, please tell us more about Palestine. And Palestine is the birthplace of Jesus Christ. Recently, I just heard a message from Bishop Atallah Hana, who is currently in Palestine, who was telling that you are not allowed to be happy on the birthday of Jesus Christ until Palestine is going to be free. Tell us more about that that part of the story, and how Palestine is also uniting actually all the religions, Muslims, Christians, and even Jews.
As you know, the true approach to religion is a peaceful approach. Yet it is also an approach that takes into consideration justice and injustice. Therefore, Palestine is the cradle country of Bani Israel. Let us call them Bani Israel more than Judaism. And the reason behind this, they were called Jews after Ezra returned from Babylon. And that was around 586 BCE when they returned and they were from the southern kingdom of Judea. They were called Jews of Judaism. But that term is wrong. It does not represent really all the children of Israel according to Quran Karim and to even our holy books. This is why we say, as we see today, lots of the Jews who are in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem, who hate, they hate the Zionist state. They consider it the state of the devil, the state of Iblis.
Exactly.
And if we want to name some of them, we can name the Satmar, the Noturei Karta. Even among the Yemenite Jews, the Haredim in Jerusalem, they despise this Zionist state. They call it the state of Satan. And for the Christians, as well as for the Muslims, let us not forget that Al-Aqsa and Qubbat al-Sakhra, let us not forget Al-Isra, Laylat al-Isra wal-Mi'raj, Laylat al-Qadr, when Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam ascended into heaven. It was from that particular spot, Al-Quds, the holy place. Also for us as a Christian, we care very much for this Palestinian nationalistic voice. We do not want to be ruled by the Greeks, and we don't want to be ruled by the Italians. We need the Catholic Christians in Palestine to be fully and solely Palestinians, and for the Orthodox to be solely Palestinians. We are occupied by nations that consider that they can basically take care of us when indeed we can take care of ourselves. The Palestinian mission, whether it is among the Jews, whether it is among the Samaritans, whether it is among the Christians, whether it is among the Christians even themselves, the Palestinian mission is a Palestinian towards unity. Even our factions, even our organizations, we try to promote this understanding. We promote this cooperation. We promote this coexistence, because all Palestine is important for us as religious leaders. In my case, and the case of Sayyidina Archbishop Atallah Hanna, we promote that unity. We promote that peace. We promote that coexistence. We promote that cooperation in order to work together and at the same time to preserve Palestine. Because the enemy, the Zionist enemy, tries in all his ways to create wars between us, to keep us divided. We will not succumb to such a thing.
But
and
Father,
we will conquer at the end. We will conquer, and we have seen such a victory in the last Intifada, Saif al-Quds, when the Palestinians of Land 48, the Palestinians of Duffa, the Palestinians in Gaza, the Palestinians everywhere in the world felt this fire for Palestine.
Thank you very much, Father Antonius Hanania from Syria. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to speak to you.
You're very welcome.
And may Allah bless you. And let's pray for free Palestine. Thank you so much.
Ameen, Ya Rab.
Thank you so much.
Allah kun ma'akum. Inshallah khair, Ya Rab.
Yes, this was my interview with Father Hanania, Antonius Hanania, an Akkawian Palestinian Syrian priest, Christian Syrian priest. Let's shift to the next part of our program. Next part of our program is again about another personal dimension of the life and behavior of Sheikh General Qasem Soleimani, how he was caring the family of the Shuhada, the family of the martyrs and the orphans. Stay with us.
He was a friend in life as well as in death. Qasem Soleimani often said, "We owed our security to the sacrifice made by the martyrs, and so we have a responsibility towards their families." He used to make calls on the families to solve whatever problems they might have. It goes without saying, they wouldn't be turned away if they took the first step and requested his time. He was a father to the martyrs' children and a son to their parents. There are many accounts of the general sending his ring to a martyr's family upon the soldier's request before death, to surprise comfort calls and helping a boy get the girl he wants. Martyr Rezai's wife recalls, "My son was emotionally not in a good place after he lost his father, so I thought he best get married, as this should help him recover. The day to propose to our chosen girl came, but none of my late husband's relatives would accompany us. My son was really upset. One night he dreamt of his father saying, 'Don't worry, son, one of my brothers in arms will come to you. We expected anyone but General Soleimani. Still, when my son was out for a test, I got his letter to the general. My son had left the number and address of the bride-to-be in the letter. The designated night came, and we set out for her house. We'd been there just a few minutes when the bell rang. They opened the door to find the general. Everyone wept in shock and joy for a quarter of an hour. His presence was an honor and made for a successful night. A marriage sermon was recited that same night, with 14 gold coins assigned as the girl's alimony. General Soleimani made us promise not to print the affair anywhere, as he truly wouldn't have the means to do the same for all the martyrs' children, although he found himself duty-bound to do so for Rezai's son, given his high regard for his father, and because of the dream by a martyr's child. The general would participate in ceremonies for the martyrs' children and engaged with them. Whatever gifts he received at these assemblies, he would present to their families then and there. The attention he paid to the families was not just at times when he was in Iran. Even when in Syria or Iraq, he contacted martyrs' families and asked of their situation. Martyr Nosrati's daughter tells of a day her doorbell rang. She felt it was her father at the door, 33 years after his martyrdom. It was the general. He came in and hugged and conversed with her children like a kind grandfather. He then told her son, Muhammad Hussein, to bring a piece of paper to write to his father. On it he wrote, "Take care of my daughter," meaning the daughter of Martyr Nosrati.
If God did not repel some people by means of others, many monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques, where God's name is much invoked, would have been destroyed. The Holy Quran, chapter 22, verse number 40. Wassalam.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It's not out of the question. It appears President Biden's war budgets are going to look a lot like President Trump's war budgets, says Andrew Lutz Ryder in an article titled, "Meet the Biden War Budget, Same as the Trump War Budget." Stay tuned for more. President Biden took a remarkably different approach than former President Trump when the two faced off on the 2020 presidential campaign trail, both in style and in substance. You would hardly know the difference between the two, though, solely based on the $777 billion defense policy bill President Biden signed into law 2 days after the Christmas holiday. Organizations representing both progressive interests and more fiscally conservative perspectives had urged Biden earlier last year to pull back on the huge defense budget increases that occurred during the former President Trump's 4 years in office. From the defense budget just before President Trump took office, fiscal year 2017, to the last one Trump signed into law, fiscal year 2021, Department of Defense spending grew a staggering $98 billion, or 16%. The DoD's budget grew by $65 billion in Trump's fiscal first year, $17 billion in his second term, and $35 billion in his third year, before shrinking $19.5 billion in his final year. What's worse, that big $65 billion budget increase and the $25 billion increase in President Biden's final budget for the fiscal year 2017 were approved by Republican majorities in both chambers of Congress, despite the GOP's professed concern for fiscal responsibility. As noted, experts and advocates across the ideological spectrum were hoping President Biden would assume some leadership in advocating for a reduced defense budget relative to the Trump years. Biden would surely experience resistance from the defense hawks in Congress in both parties. The thinking went, but he could give this reduced, more sustainable defense budget a major boost with Congress by advocating for it within the president's annual budget request. Unfortunately, President Biden's first defense budget request was largely unambitious and effectively held spending flat relative to former President Trump's final year in office. At the very least, the first Biden budget request did not advocate for major increases to the defense budget, unlike President Trump and his first defense budget. Based on the reaction from major military boosters in Congress, though, you would have thought the sky had fallen. Republicans called the budget request reckless and even dangerous. A dozen Senate Democrats on the Armed Services Committee voted last summer to fatten up Biden's budget request by $25 billion, with only Senator Elizabeth Warren having the courage to vote no on tens of billions of dollars more for the military and the contractors that support it. And so the defense policy bill President Biden signed into law authorizes $740 billion in spending on the military, along with an additional $27 billion for nuclear weapons under the Department of Energy, and $1 billion for miscellaneous defense needs, $25 billion more than President Biden's $715 billion budget request, and $36 billion more than the $704 billion spent on the military in the last fiscal year. This larding up of the defense budget is happening even as the U.S. has ended major military operations in Afghanistan, and even as Congress is dedicating separate emergency funds to resolving the catastrophes that arose there. The press releases from senator or member of the House will talk about the 2.7% pay increase for the troops, or a whole of the government response to the climate crisis. Some of these initiatives are politically popular, but that's not where lawmakers are porking up the budget. Spending on military personnel is actually down relative to fiscal year 2021. What's up then? Procurement, that is acquisition of new ships, planes, and weapons for the military gets a major boost in the new defense budget. $15 billion or 11.1% more than the Biden budget request. Research and development spending, often on new ships, planes, and weapons that have yet to be built and procured, is also up a big $5.7 billion or 5.1% from the president's budget request. This extra spending will buy the Navy new ships, prevent the Navy from retiring ships that it wants to retire, and allow the service branches to purchase plenty of new aircraft, combat vehicles, autonomous systems, missiles, and ammunition. Much of the extra spending goes to so-called unfunded priorities requests of the military branches and combatant commands. Organization National Taxpayer Union calls them wish lists. In fact, they are more like stocking stuffers tacked on to make the Christmas time defense budget extra special for military officials and contractors than essential presents under the tree. Think lawmakers have fiscal responsibility at the Pentagon under 2022 New Year's resolution list? Think again. Representative Mike Rogers, the top Republican on the House Armed Services Committee, is already warning that the work is not finished and that combating will continue to be number one priority as they look ahead of fiscal year 23. Unfortunately for the nation's taxpayers, what combating these two nations often means is not spending smarter, but spending more. Will they see an $800 billion military budget in 2022 for fiscal year 2023? It's not out of the question. It appears President Biden's war budgets are going to look a lot like President Trump's war budgets. Economic divide.
We have reached the end of the year 2021. Lots has happened, but on the economic front, it was not a good year. And that was mainly due to one thing, a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence, a pandemic, scarring maybe a generation, its economic impact so severe that it can still sink the world. Hi, I'm Kavitat Wai. These are the topics that we have chosen for the end-of-the-year program. So let's get going. First, the COVID shock from inflation to supply chain disruptions and massive price increases in energy. Citizens of the majority of countries are suffering economically as a result. Another topic that we have chosen for this program, the decline of the U.S. dollar. A massive worry for the U.S., digital currencies on the one hand, and then major economies like China and Russia opting to choose national currencies for bilateral trade. Also, take a look at petro-yuan and how that contributes to the decline of the U.S. dollar. Trading blocks without the U.S. The SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of which Iran became a member, and also take a look at RCEP, which is one of the biggest trading blocks in the world, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Next up, climate change. That was a big story from this past year. You had the Glasgow conference, a lot of hype, and typical of previous conferences, no real pledges to reduce carbon gas emissions, pledges to have fallen short. Another topic that was hot for this past year, the U.S.-China trade war, still ongoing. No thaw in trade relations. U.S. still continuing with its tariffs, and China rejecting the U.S. pressure as a result. The year 2021 did not see the U.S.-China trade war decrease in its intensity. The arrival of Joe Biden in the White House was seen by many, both within the U.S. and within China, that things may ease between the two when it came to their trade war. But those hopes were dashed as soon as Biden came into power. Not only did the Biden administration say that it would not remove the Trump administration's tariffs, it would also require that Beijing uphold its trade commitments. The Biden administration is keen on requiring China uphold the terms of the initial trade agreement that was signed in January of 2020.
Today we take a momentous step, one that has never been taken before with China, toward a future of fair and reciprocal trade as we sign phase one of the historic trade deal between the United States and China. Together we are righting the wrongs of the past and delivering a future of economic justice and security for American workers, farmers, and families.
And this is going to be a great agreement for both countries. It's far greater than $200 billion, and it'll grow every year. It also unifies the countries.
The trade deal included open Chinese markets to more American companies, increased farm and energy exports, and provide greater protection for American technology and trade secrets. As part of the deal, China committed to buy an additional $200 billion worth of American goods and services in 2021. China would also ease some of the tariffs that it placed on American products. Most notably, however, the agreement kept most of the tariffs that Trump had placed on $360 billion worth of Chinese goods. The U.S. also said that if China did not uphold its end of the bargain, it would risk penalties. And that is what happened. As the year 2021 progressed, China fell short of its 2021 commitments by more than 30%. And as for the year 2020, the year that the deal was signed, it fell short by more than 40%. And this was in line with Biden's even tougher approach towards China than his predecessor for the year 2021. The views from the White House towards China were that it was a rising economic and security threat and had to be dealt with. All right, joining us to discuss this is Bill Fletcher, Jr., expert on trade unionism. International affairs is another one of his specialties. Also, we are going to have Justin Muirapart Stewart, who's the founder of Regionally, join us later. Both of them will be making contributions to this program on the topics that we chose for the year in review. Okay, I'd like to welcome both of you, but let me first start with you, if I may, Bill. We're looking at the U.S.-China trade war, still one of the top stories, economically speaking. It may be overshadowed by COVID, obviously, but what is going on between the two when it comes to the trade war? Is it still ongoing the way that it has been based on what Trump signed with Xi Jinping when he was in office? And how do things stand right now? What transpired this year?
What's complicated about the U.S.-China economic contention is the reality that our economies, that is the Chinese and the U.S., are so interpenetrated. There is just massive Chinese investment in the United States and massive U.S. investment in China. So it changes what we mean by competition. It's not just two traditional blocs that are unrelated and are just fighting it out economically. The second thing is that part of what we're seeing is a contention at the state level that revolves around two different approaches to the current crisis of global capitalism.
The money COVID has knocked off the world economy is staggering. The virus has in fact knocked off $9 trillion worth of stock value. With global stock markets around the world, like the Nikkei in Japan, the Dow Jones in the US, the CAC 40 in France, and the S&P all losing at least 3% of their value. Another source has said that COVID was on track to actually wipe out $16 trillion worth of global wealth. Boston Consulting Group said volatile markets and the economic fallout could wipe out as much as $16 trillion of global wealth this year and to hinder growth for the next 5 years. In terms of global wealth this year, that is what has happened. And that is higher than the 2008 financial crisis, which erased $10 trillion. Looking at it another way, just imagine how long it would take to gain back this amount of loss in revenue. But the economic fallout from COVID-19 could not be more alarming than what Bank of America core strategists revealed. The cost of saving the global economy, $834 million an hour, a figure spent for 18 months in a row. That is how much central banks spent buying bonds since the pandemic hit. The New York Fed in the U.S., $4 trillion. On the other hand, there were some who increased their wealth during the pandemic from this past year. Personal financial wealth reached $226 trillion globally last year, a 9% gain from the year 2018 and the strongest annual growth rate since the year 2005. But perhaps the biggest threat to world economies was inflation, something that has plagued countries around the world. Consumers are seeing higher prices for goods and services. Here are two examples. In the U.S., the Consumer Price Index, which tracks what consumers pay for goods and services, rose by 6.2% in October compared to a year ago, the fastest increase since the year 1990.
Yes, prices are going up extremely, and I'd be so glad when they come down. You know, due to the COVID, people don't have money. We just starting back to work and stuff like that. This is outrageous, the prices of the gas today.
In a way, he inherited a lot of this when he took office in January. Like, the stimulus checks and the inflation were already going up at the time, so I'm not sure it's really anything necessarily related to Biden specifically or just the circumstances of the coronavirus. I mean, I think generally the policy that he's been pushing for has been the right idea. But of course, the stimulus checks won't last forever and inflation can't stay at 6%, so that remains to be seen.
Meanwhile, the Eurozone saw its inflation at about 4.1%, the highest in 13 years. One thing that was a common factor when it came to inflation was supply chain disruptions.
What's causing this is we're living in a global pandemic, and I think we can't lose sight of that. And I think we have to remember that the supply chain issue is not just simply about unloading ships here in the harbor. It's also about filling containers in other parts of the world that also shut down factories. And I think as we continue to move forward here, as we continue to get more people vaccinated, as we continue to come through this, we will be stronger.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to our in-depth section. We will continue this section from our COVID-19 package, which covered the economic impact of COVID-19 on the world economy. But in this section, we will look at the supply chain disruptions in detail. Now, COVID-19 had an obvious impact on supply and demand around the world. Getting products to end users is a challenge in itself under normal circumstances, but did you think about the different stages necessary for a product to be produced? Well, we're going to try to do that here in this section. So let's get started. Now, when the pandemic began, an economic slowdown began taking shape. This impact was pretty severe. People did not buy as much as before. They bought basics, for example, more, and then other things less, generally speaking. Okay? So that much we're clear on. Now, as a result of the slowdown, things as a consequence happened. For example, you had stores that were closed or began closing, factories from Asia to Europe and to North America halted production, companies laid off workers en masse, some of the consequences. But please note, all of this was not uniform. For example, layoff numbers varied from industry to industry. Okay, since there was an economic slowdown, now this pretty normal to think reduction in shipping due to economic slowdown was a result of that. So that much was a given. But then something happened that took the whole world by surprise. You had an influx of supplies from China, in which China was forced to export PPEs, protection gear, to all corners of the world. What happened as a result? There was a container pileup, then there was a shortage of containers in China to ship out things like masks, surgical gloves, etc. Now, another thing that happened as a result of this pandemic is that people began shopping online at a high rate. As a result, increase in demand for durable goods happened, and then more shortage of shipping containers, durable goods like furniture, televisions, computers, things of that nature, things that people would usually buy in person. Okay? Consequence, component shortages, just-in-time manufacturing happened for things like chips, medical devices, and computer parts. Just-in-time manufacturing. Can you imagine that? That means when the demand came, that's when the manufacturers would go into gear to produce the products. Some of the things that we just mentioned, things like chips and components within and parts for all kinds of machinery, etc. So, what do we have? We have a supply chain disruption that at this point is projected to continue in the year 2022. And that is not good news for the world economy. Okay, let's try to figure some of this out with our guest who joins us for this section. We have Justin Urquhart Stewart. He's the founder of Regionally, who rejoins us. Okay, Justin Urquhart, one of the consequences of COVID-19, we just went through supply chain disruptions, has been inflation, a result of that, one of the results anyways. And it's almost across the board, things like food, energy resources to have gone up, etc. The UK, where you are, 10-year high in inflation, and the US at a 30-year high. What is going to happen with inflation? Is it going to get tamed?
Inflation is possibly the most dangerous element of the economy we can see at the moment. The problem is, most people haven't, this generation haven't seen inflation for 20, 30 years at these sort of levels. And I can go back to the 1970s when we had inflation at 25%. And that really is devastating to an economy unless you manage it very carefully. Now, we're unlikely to go back to those sort of levels. But even inflation of 5, 6, 7% can be very difficult. And certainly input inflation in Europe, we're now seeing about 10%, which means it's about 5% by the time it gets through to the consumer. So it's likely that a part of that will drop off next year. But we don't know how much of it is embedded into the system in things like pay rise and those sort of areas. So that's going to be a very worrying area the economy to try and deal with, that it starts squeezing the benefits of economic growth. And certainly inflation, that's properly managed, can be absolutely devastating.
All right, indeed. Well, we're going to have to see whether inflation is going to stick around for this coming year or not. Justin Urquhart there with his comments. Okay, we're going to now take a look at one of the topics that we picked out for this program, and that topic is going to revolve around the dollar. Now, we've covered the fall of the dollar on a number of occasions. Did that actually happen this past year, and if so, by how much? Well, let's be honest. One of the reasons is the way that the U.S. has used it as a political tool to undermine the economies of countries that it does not like. Iran is one of them, along with Russia, China, Cuba, and Venezuela. But more and more economists are of the belief that the days of the dollar being the dominant form of money may be numbered. During the past year, did the U.S. dollar decline in its value? That is the key question that many economists have debated. Let's look at the current value. The U.S. dollar currency index is down 4% from its 2021 peak. As a result, it is the worst performer of the world's major currencies so far this quarter. So what is going on? Why is the U.S. dollar declining? One of the major reasons is that the U.S. government had an exorbitant spending program than other countries that continues almost by the second.